Mics are live.
Well, good morning, everyone. It is 10:03 a.m., Tuesday, February 18th, 2020. I'm Commissioner Brian Crashus, joined by Commissioner Julie Podorchak and Commissioner Randy Chrisman. And then we also have a couple of staff members, and we'll go around the table. But before we do that, welcome. I appreciate the time that you're giving us this morning to give us the biannual update for SPP. And look forward to the discussion ahead and hopefully answering some of the questions I have, including just what's driving ultimately the drivers of the changes that we're looking at with the grid itself. So any opening comments, Commissioner Podorchak?
Just briefly. These are really great conversations to have. There's so much happening in the whole world of RTOs, and it affects customers a great deal. And ultimately, I think that's the lens that all of us have when we look at this stuff, is how does what you all do serve the interest of providing really reliable utility services to customers at the lowest possible cost. And so it's easy to lose sight of those things sometimes when you get down into the weeds and start talking about the nitty-gritty of operations and that sort of thing. But I view that as the role of the regulators, and the reason why we have a kind of a special seat at the table in both MISO and SPP, because we represent those interests and can always drive the conversation back to those two important goals. So thanks for your work to that end, and I really appreciate the partnership and the working relationship that we've got with you all.
And then Commissioner Chrisman, of course, you are heavily involved with SPP, so I know we've got, I wonder if we shouldn't just do some quick intros and then we'll circle back to you.
Why don't I just cover, I don't have a lot to talk about, but I just will say now it's almost 2.5 years that I've been doing the SPP portfolio and I'm a member of the RSC, which is the Regional State Committee. Lee and Ben have been super helpful to Victor and I the whole time. I'm newer to meeting Charles, who's here today to provide some information that they were kind enough to discuss with us, you know, what all things we wanted to talk about at this discussion and prepare a little bit. And SPPs, and I see some slides in here, so I'm going to go through it, but having some big transitions here with a new president and CEO coming up. The outgoing president and CEO, who will be on board, I believe, through about the end of April, has held that position for pretty much the whole time. And so big transition there and other changes throughout the organization. So we'll hear about it from them. But welcome you guys up here. We get to chase around at your meetings 4 times a year at the least, plus sometimes at some NARUC meetings and such. But it's nice when you can come up here and spend a little more time one-on-one with an individual state and help guide us through what's going on, and so we can prepare and make the best possible decisions for North Dakota.
Perfect. Okay, then we have someone on the phone, I believe. Can you let us know who you are?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, this is Lynn Walters from Otter Tail Power.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Jason Weyers from Otter Tail Power Company.
Welcome. Okay, anyone else from Otter Tail or other representatives on the line? Okay, I think that covers who is on the line today, and then why don't we just go around the table, starting with Adam.
Adam Renfant, staff.
Victor Shook with staff.
Charles Hendricks, Southwest Power Pole staff.
Ben Bright, SPP staff.
Lee Elliott, SPP staff.
Okay, well, again, thank you, and you can just go right into your presentation. Look forward to it.
Okay. Well, I'll get kicked off. Again, my name's Ben Bright. I'm with SPP staff. I am part of our regulatory department. With me, I have Lee Elliott and Charles Hendricks, and I'll let them introduce themselves as we get going. Go back one slide. So what we thought we'd talk about today are four things. Again, the organizational changes that Commissioner Christman already sort of mentioned. We'll go through those. We'll talk about our effective load carrying capability process that we've undertaken at SPP. Charles will cover that. Lee is going to cover just an overview, an update on the OMS-RSC SEAMS Liaison Committee, which I think Commissioner Fedorchuk sits as part of that. Mm-hmm. And then I'll come back and talk about just some things SPP has going on in the West. And then after that, if you have any other questions for SPP, we'd be happy to take those. And anytime along the way, feel free to just stop us and engage in conversation. So if we go to the organizational changes. So back in April, I think, of 2019, Nick Brown, our current CEO and president, announced that on or about April 1st of 2020, he would be leaving. So what that did is put our board of directors in a task of going and searching out a new replacement. They did that through an internal and external search. I think they had it down to about five candidates at the end, some internals and externals. And then on January 15th, the board announced that Barbara Sugg, who is our current senior VP of IT, would be assuming that role of president and CEO. So Barbara's been around SPP since 1997, always in an IT role, became the VP of IT in 2010. And, you know, is now going to be taking over the CEO role. I think it's important, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years with just the emergence of all of the SIP regulations. So she is our senior SIP manager, information security officer, things like that. So I think it's just a shows the importance and the value that we place on those kind of things in SPP and going forward and how big of those things are to our business as a whole. Just information security. So, you know, as she's been named, I think she's got three sort of main focuses that she's laid out in a couple of press releases. A continued focus on value and affordability of the RTO, Western expansion, which we'll talk about today, and then also the continued unity of our stakeholders, members, and regulators through a new strategic planning process we're going to undertake in 2020. So they'll be putting together a group within our strategic planning committee, a subgroup that will focus on a new strategic plan for SPP going into the future. Along with Barbara's announcement, Carl Monroe, who had been our chief operating officer for at least the last 15 years that I'm aware of. He also announced his retirement. His retirement was effective the last day in January. And with that, Laney Nickel, who had once been our senior vice president of engineering, took over now the role of chief operations officer. So with chief operations officer, he now has all of engineering, all of markets, all of operations, and all of information technology that fall underneath him. So quite a big role jump for Laney as well. Again, Laney been around since 1997 with SPP as well. Had been the VP of engineering since 2008. So then after that, on January the 30th, they announced two more changes that all sort of come in line with those two previous changes. Antoine Lucas, who had been our director of engineering, who if you've been around SPP meetings, probably know Antoine. So he's now the vice president of engineering. And Sam Ellis, who had been our over our cybersecurity part of our business, had been a director of cybersecurity, is now the vice president of IT and our chief information security officer. So a bunch of familiar faces going with new roles, just sort of enhanced roles. And so I'm sure there'll be more to come as those positions get backfilled. And you know, over the first part of Barbara's tenure as president and CEO, I'm sure we'll see some changes in the organization that come through out of that. I don't know if you have any questions about that or anything about SPP's kind of where we're going. Okay. If not, I will turn it over to Charles.
Hi, good morning. I'm Charles Hendricks in the Reliability Assurance Department at SPP. We are in the system planning organization, which was Antoine's group. Antoine is now moved up to VP of Engineering, so we're still in the engineering group under Antoine. My department has two main focuses. One, we're the planning coordinator. We do the planning coordinator assessments, which kind of roll up to NERC for NERC compliance. The other is the resource adequacy of SPP. We started a resource adequacy policy through our attachment AA of the tariff, and I think 2019 was the first year of that, and so that's starting the second year this year, so that's going well. For effective today, I want to talk to you about our effective load carrying capability methodology, which goes by just the acronym ELCC. So we'll kind of have an outline here. So first off, kind of talk about just real basic resource adequacy concepts. We'll talk about the how we currently accredit our wind and solar in SPP. Then we'll talk a little bit more about ELCC, how our working group, the supply adequacy working group, actually evaluated ELCC and determined that that was the direction we needed to head. Then talk very briefly about the actual studies that we did to determine the actual capacity that we can get from wind and solar through the ELCC methodology. And then once you determine how much capacity you can get from a group of resources, you have to determine how you're going to actually allocate that on a per installation basis. And then we'll talk a little bit about where we are. The policy's been approved. We still don't yet have our governing documents, and we'll kind of talk about that. So high-level resource adequacy, as I said, we now have it as a binding policy in our tariff. Prior to 2019, we kind of had a reserve margin requirement in our criteria, but now we've moved it over to the tariff so that it impacts all members and non-members alike, and anybody that signs the load, the market agreement, market participation agreement with SPP is now and serves load is now applicable to that policy. So resource adequacy is basically you're establishing longer-term planning margins required to ensure that resources are available to serve load under normal and contingency conditions. We're determining that we will set a planning reserve margin, so we need to determine how much capacity you have to serve your load, and then how much capacity you have to have in addition to serving your load to account for those contingencies, generator outages, high wind, low wind, unexpected load forecast, load uncertainty. And then another pillar of our resource adequacy is, we expect the accredited capacity to be there when we need it. So kind of focusing straight on wind, the current accreditation policy we have for wind, it was adopted in 2004. We basically looked at, you take a single wind farm, you see what the output of that wind farm is, how it performs against the peak hour of the load serving entity. It had looked at basically the top 10% of the hours. If we didn't get any information from the load serving entity, then they would get a flat 3%. This worked fine when we only had less than 1,000 megawatts on the system. In 2014, we actually updated the methodology to kind of nail that down to the top 3% of load hours. We were just focusing on that. The actual history why we did that in 2014, I'm not exactly sure, but we did tighten that up to the top 3% of load hours, and then we allowed a 5% accreditation if the LSC did not provide any load information. Since that time, we've had a lot of transmission expansion, which I'm sure you're aware of, which has precipitated a lot of renewable development, or wind development specifically. So we're currently, we're over 20,000 megawatts of nameplate wind in SPP's footprint currently from across the footprint. So with the current methodology, when you're looking at just how a single wind farm is performing with that peak hour, and then you take another and you start looking at all your wind farms and you're focusing on the same hours, you stand the, like if you take the top 3%, if you look at how all that wind is impacting those 3% hours, you may be really performing well against those load hours, but there you could be shifting the load to outside of those top 3% load hours. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But that's kind of where that kind of brings us to the ELCC methodology. So the ELCC, again, it stands for Effective Load Carrying Capability. It's defined as the amount of incremental load that a resource, and it doesn't have to be a wind resource or a solar resource, it can be any resource, can dependably and reliably serve during our peak hours. So we actually do this by performing a loss of load expectation study, which is how we actually set the planning reserve margin through the LOLE process. But we'll do an LOLE study on the system without the resources in question. Then we'll do another LOLE study with the resources in question. Just real quick on LOLE, what we look at for there is the metric is the industry metric is a benchmark metric. It's one day in 10 years, which is for 10 years of time, you're planning for there could be at least one day of lost energy during that 10-year time period. Next slide. So the example here, if you look kind of how I described, you'll see actually the load on the bottom. There's the your existing system. We run our analysis and we can determine, we're going to be able to serve 58,757 megawatts with the system without adding whatever resource we want to study. We'll then add in 19,339 megawatts of wind. And we will run it again, and we'll determine that we can now serve reliably 61,800 megawatts. So the ELC simplified calculation is you're getting 3,117 megawatts of capacity from that wind fleet. And this in this case is just the fleet scattered all over across the footprint. So, but always everybody always jumps to accreditation. So to get the accreditation, that's the capacity is your 3,117 megawatts of capacity divided by how much actual nameplate. So that wind could actually get up to 19,000 megawatts at the right time with in the right conditions. But for what we're looking at, it's only at 3,117. So then there's an average accreditation of the wind fleet of 16% for ELCC in that case. Any questions on that? Okay, next slide. So what I was trying to explain, this is boiling it down to 2 hours while ago. So in this particular, this was 2014. August 21st, 2014 was our biggest load hour was 4 o'clock. So we had 51,519 megawatts of load on the system. Now, the gray is at that particular hour, the wind was performing quite well. So we had, we had about 9,000 megawatts of wind online at that hour. So what was left to serve for the rest of the system was 42,000 megawatts. However, if you look at our second highest load in that year, that was on July 22nd, which we had 50,800 megawatts of load. The wind was not performing near as well at that particular hour. So what the ELCC methodology looks at is when we put new wind on, it's not necessarily looking at the 51,000 load hour. It's looking how are you performing at the 50,000 load hour. And the more wind you put on, you'll shift that later on. And you could hit an hour where, it looks real good. So you get high accreditation. You can see some bumps like that. But this is just boiling it down to kind of 2 hours. Of course, we're looking at our ELCC study and our LOE study. We're looking at 8760 hours, and we're up to 7 or 8 years of data that we run this through.
Going back, I think it ties in a little bit to this slide, but the slide before, you said under the right conditions, the 19,339.
Yes, sir. Well, that's the max nameplate. I don't know that we've ever had 100%.
Right. Do you know what the highest output has ever been?
17. the actual, yeah, 17, 18 gig out of probably, you know, almost 20 gigs. So it's gotten up to close to 90, 95%. I can recall even, several years ago when we only had 14 or 15, I calculated it myself when during the peak, and it was around 93% of nameplate.
Did you consider that, though, an unusual event in terms of ideal weather conditions?
We hit a similar peak. I mean, every year we'll get maybe to that. But, as far as across the year, that would be unusual.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so on to how SPP, how we decided to attack ELCC. So,
I'm sorry, I'm still thinking about the last two slides, but so how do you? And this might just be a repetitive question, but how do you account? What's the lowest? I mean, 19,000 is the max. What's the lowest that you're? Whole wind fleet has
we've seen
provided.
Some pretty low as we get more and more it's I don't know if it's the right, but I think we've seen it down to 800,000 megawatts with this fleet.
And how do you account for that? Is that in the accreditation?
Well, the LOLE, it's a probabilistic analysis, so we're looking at, probabilities of our conventional generation fleet staying on. We're looking at probabilities of the load being higher, the load being lower. Looking at, what's this wind going to do? So there could be, if we determine that extremely low wind output coincides with the time where we have a whole lot of conventional generator outages and we have really high load, that's what will trigger the LOLE threshold. So we will hit that, and you'll have to back the load down to try to figure out what the real ELCC value is. I mean, you're pointing out it's not 100% foolproof, mm-hmm. but it's a probabilistic analysis.
And that's always backwards looking.
We're trying to get more data. We haven't had wind on the system that long, especially large amounts of wind on the system that long. So we've got about 7 years of good data. If what we're told with our software vendors is that once you get at least 30 years of weather data, then you can pretty much count on it. But right now we're not there yet.
We're not. It's at the 30 years. We'll probably have a different technology in 30 years. So
that was pretty correct. So it was about a little over 17,800 megawatts online high, and around 897 is sort of in the recent low we've seen.
897.
Yeah.
And is that? Can you give me the context for the low? I'm not as worried about the high because, you've got the power and other stuff just gets right. adjusted. It's the low that needs to be known and accounted for and make sure that, that's not hitting and during the polar vortex or one of those key times in the summer where you've got to have the power available.
Yeah, I think it was just in December of last year, actually.
And is it typically that? Is it kind of a seasonal time where you can predict that?
I'm not exactly sure of the lows. I know the highs. We do a fairly good job of predicting sort of the wind peaks.
Mm-hmm.
The lows, whether or not that's the wind actually shutting, there not being any wind. Is it the wind blowing too hard? Where they have to shut down some of the turbines? Is it too cold mm-hmm. that they have to shut down some turbines? I'm not exactly sure how well they forecast that or how they do that.
Well, they're looking at 7 days out, and right. they can say, three or 4 days out, the wind forecast is really low. And so they'll start getting conventional. Some of these conventional units may take a day or two to get going, and they'll bring those on.
So it's help me understand why I shouldn't be more worried that you're not more up to speed on the lows. like the fact that you you don't seem all you know about the highs, but you're not that concerned about the lows.
Well, we are concerned about the lows. I mean, there's been some discussions at our Market and Operations Policy Committee that C.J. Brown's our director of operations. He's made some presentations, particularly on this past summer where we did have some lows. The operations group is actually they've formed a team that that my group actually participates in as well, called the Uncertainty Response Team, and I'm not 100% up on everything it's doing, but that is a major focus of our operations group, is to when that wind is going to be well below where we need it to be, what our reactions are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it is on our radar.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but part of the whole ELCC working group is looking into not just what the lows are, but the probability that they'll be at different seasons of the year, correct?
Right. So we're looking out, 5 years out, on what do we think the right amount of what is the right portfolio of generation to have out there 5 years from now to actually accommodate when we do have a low. In 5 years. So when you're looking 5 years out, 10 years out, we're looking more on the probabilistics. Our operations group, yes, they're looking real time. They're looking tomorrow. They're looking a week out, a month out. So they are taking a different approach to actually keeping the lights on, in real time.
Mm-hmm.
I think both are important, lows and highs. I am concerned about the highs from a standpoint. That's when you're displacing other existing resources. And that is a huge concern in North Dakota in terms of our generating fleet, a significant portion being lignite. So when that occurs, I think it's safe to assume that displacement of existing resources occurs at the same time. And they're spinning, they're cycling, and that adds cost as well as and it's a good point, the lows are very concerning too. That can certainly add cost to the system as well for consumers. Ultimately, that's my concern, is how does all of this impact the ratepayer? So, but thanks. Thank you for answering the different questions.
And maybe with some of these other results, we can answer, make you feel better about what we're looking at. All right, so back on the SOG. Okay, Supply Adequacy Working Group. This is the working group that looks at resource adequacy from the planning perspective. We were the SOG actually charged SPP staff to go back and look at the use of ELC's methodology to see how it's being used across the country. And it turns out just about all the RTOs, ISOs are using ELCC, and several of the large entities out in the West are using ELCC as well. We wanted to determine the reliability need for establishing the ELCC methodology in SPP, which, to your point, is how much load are we really going to be able to count on to serve from wind? And if there's something else we need to do, then this will be at least a guidepost for us. Determine the amount of credited capacity from the wind and solar in SPP on our methodology. Then we want to compare these ELCC results to our current accreditation criteria. And lastly, we haven't gotten too far with batteries yet, but we are looking at energy storage resources, about what the capacity will be with that. Okay, so these are the results from our ELCC analysis for wind. So as you'll look, about in the middle there, I think it says 20. We've got about 19,000, so that I think that 40% is we're looking at, if we have 40% of penetration of wind resources, so that's 20,608 megawatts of wind. So what ELCC is telling us is we can only accredit through the probabilistic analysis, we're looking at 3,800 megawatts of capacity. Our existing criteria at that level would say, well, we could count on 5,400 megawatts of capacity. Because of the way I described the existing criteria, you have a flat line on the green line for the existing criteria. As you add more wind, you'll see that that will slightly decline to the point that if we get up to 40,000 megawatts of wind, we'll be able to count on 5,600 megawatts of capacity from that wind. And you'll see that gap really widens with our existing criteria. So we took this as staff and as SOG, is that we need to head this way to better prepare, because if our members, if we think that, you know, we're going to get 10,000 megawatts of capacity out of our wind farm, then we really need to educate everybody and let them know that if you're thinking you're going to serve so much of your load from wind, you're going to need twice as much wind. So maybe that kind of helps where you were going with that.
And is that the actual, it's just twice as much, it's not, that's the actual comparison, double the wind?
Well, build. In this case, like I said, using the ELCC methodology, you have 40,000 megawatts of wind in the, you know, nameplate in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So when the wind is blowing, it, you know, you can get 40,000 megawatts, but for our summer accreditation, we're saying you can only count on 5,600 out of that 40,000.
So
now,
if you want the 10,000,
it's not the 800 that you could possibly see at, you know, any given time. But if that 800 or 900 that we saw is not during a high peak period, then it's not going to show up as a loss of load, as a loss of load event. But the low periods are is what's bringing that down to 5,600.
Can you, on the bottom percentages of this graph, can you tell me what those are? The 10, 20, 30.
Okay, so that is the SPP's peak across the footprints around 50,000 megawatts. So this is, if you had the 70%, is if we had 36,000 megawatts of nameplate wind, that is considered a 70% penetration to our peak load.
Okay. But yet it would be a...
Yeah, I didn't pick a good number.
40%? Or what would be the actual...
Okay, so let's go back to,
that would be
right now we're at about 40%, so we'll just pick the 20 number. So we got about 20,000 megawatts of wind on the system right now. So at any given time, we could see 20,000 megawatts hitting the system, most likely in the spring or fall. Mm-hmm. In the summer, we're saying it's more likely we're going to see 3,845.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are, as you pointed out, the lowest of the lows will be actually below that. But from a probabilistic standpoint, it's 3,845.
What's the planning criteria line?
That is our existing criteria that we talked about, where you're looking at just individual wind farms one at a time, compared to the actual, to the load, past load of the load-serving entities.
Safe to say that's the old method?
Yes, that's the method we're moving away from.
I see. Okay.
Okay, so that's wind.
The very bottom line fundamental is that the more of the wind that you add, the lesser percentage you can count on of the total to be available in a peak time.
Yes, sir. Yes.
That's what I was just
At the end of the day, the more wind you put on the system,
the flat line, less accreditation is present, no matter how much you add.
Yeah, I mean, not that anybody thinks they're going to serve all their load with wind, but this is, you know, a guideline that says it's not very likely to happen.
Well, it seems to me quite a few of them think they probably can.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's lots of people that think that.
Well, you've got solar. I mean, we've got storage. I mean, but yes.
All right. That's a good conclusion. Thank you for pointing that out, Randy.
Okay. Well, I hope I didn't squash any of my dreams.
And could I, one other thing on that previous chart? If you wanted to make the page way taller or the graph way small, you could have a line up top that shows the total potential demand too, which in this case we would be talking about a flat line of that as well, right?
of
peak demand. In this graph, you're looking at different amounts of potential wind being added to today's amount of need.
The 51,500.
Oh yeah, the load. Okay, I didn't know if you meant the load or the actual output of the wind.
No, the total load of SPP.
Okay. Sure.
Here we're looking at keeping that. That's all assumed to be stable in this.
Okay.
Right.
Right. Yes, that's correct. And maybe the next slide will be a better place to put that because we do have megawatts on there. If we go to the next slide. So this is also wind. I was almost ready to jump ahead to solar. I got one more slide on wind. The dashed line is the capacity that we get from wind, the actual capacity. So the more wind you put on the system, you're still going to get capacity out of it. Your capacity will go up, and you can eventually get to 50,000 megawatts of load if you go far enough out. What we're focusing on is the accreditation, because as you put more wind on the system, you're getting less bang for the buck on that wind. So that's the line we just saw on the previous goal, the previous slide that's going down. But the more wind you put on, you will get capacity out of it.
And is part of the study looking? Does it differentiate between where it's added? So in your point there, you could conceivably add enough to cover everything. But if it was all in one place, it wouldn't, because then when the wind wouldn't blow, there'd still be zero. So I assume we're looking at these and counting in that they do need to be spread out some too, so that you have the likelihood of some wind somewhere.
That's a very good point. I should have made. Yes. So our current fleet of 20,000 megawatts of wind is well spread out across our footprint. So for the wind, we actually just wound up to go. You got to get to 40,000 megawatts of wind to do this study. So you either pick and choose, and the SOG went through this, you pick and choose where you're going to site that future wind, and then there's going to be disagreements over where you site that wind. It's like if you put it in a low wind potential area, it's going to make the numbers look worse. If you put it in a high wind, it's going to overestimate, and it's going to make it look better. So because we had such a diversity of wind in our footprint currently, this was basically just assuming that all future wind will have to be basically scaled in proportion to where the wind is now.
Okay.
So it won't, nobody can predict the future. It won't happen like that. But it's because we have enough diversity, we think it's a good look. And we're going to do this study every year. And we're going to update it with information of wind farms, where they're at, where they're coming in each year. And the results will slightly change each year depending upon what our input data is. Okay, let's talk about solar. So with solar, what you brought up was an issue. Currently in SPP, we only have 215 megawatts of utility-scale solar. So as you'll see, and all that solar is in New Mexico. So you see that first dot where it's 81%. That's the 215 megawatts right there. It's getting 81% accreditation, but it's all in New Mexico. We scaled that up for the ELCC that was the only one we did with the current portfolio. Our integrated transmission planning report actually cited, I think, about 4,000 megawatts of solar in the 2019 ITP. And I did not put that data in here, but they cited some in New Mexico, some in Texas. There was some in North Dakota. There may not have been any in South Dakota, but it was still heavily skewed to the south. But there was a couple of installations in North Dakota. So that was prospective solar that was run on the 2019 ITP. We took that portfolio of assets for the ELCC study, because it was 4,000, that's what the 4,282 is. We ran the ELCC on that and found that it was, with that ITP portfolio, you got 2,672 megawatts of capacity from the 4,282, and that came out to 62%. Then we took that 4,000, and similar to what we did with the wind, we started scaling it up, and we scaled it all the way up to 40,000 megawatts of solar. So you'll see there's a much more pronounced drop-off on solar, and I think it'll be more visible on the next slide when I tell you. But as you get to a certain point, you are pushing those peak hours further and further into the away from midday. You're pushing it into 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and then you're pushing it into the darkness. So obviously the solar is not going to have a good capacity value when the sun's not shining. So you kind of see that on the next slide. All right, so the dashed line is the capacity that we get from solar. And then this other line, the solid line, is brought over from the previous slide. But you'll see, and this is important to when we start talking about the allocation, the first 10,000 megawatts of solar, the dashed line, you see how it's really going up it's going up at a good clip. Once we get to about, just before you get to 10,000, you'll see it's a definite change in the curve there. You're not getting near as much capacity from the solar once you get to about 10,000 megawatts there. And eventually you get over there to 30, and it looks like it's flattening out. So that would be more representative of pushing the peak out to darkness. Now, even though you're getting 0% incremental capacity out there at 40,000, because the solid line's taking an average, you're still going to get 15% accreditation if you're just averaging things out. But so that kind of gets to how we're going to allocate these things. So if you're the first person, if you're in the first 10,000 and get accredited, you're looking good. But if we wind up putting 50,000 megawatts of solar on the system, and the average at 50,000 turns out to be 10%, you put your solar facility on there thinking you were going to get 60% accreditation, and now you're getting 10% accreditation. When it comes to our resource adequacy policy, I'm sorry.
No, that's so for your resource adequacy policy, are you moving to this ELCC or are you currently using this for your whatever capacity your voters can count?
We're moving to ELCC in 2023. We're giving everybody 3-year transition.
Okay,
but we're still using the. Of course, right now there's just so little solar on the system. We think the time is right, go ahead and move to ELCC.
Does it have significant impacts for some of your folks, this ELCC methodology, especially as it relates to their existing wind?
For the wind?
In terms
with
of the capacity?
With the installed wind we have, there's not so much. I mean, there are some that are taking a little bit of hit of accreditation. Mm-hmm. If I look, let's see. Well, this graph didn't go back. As you actually back ELCC up to like 5,000 megawatts of wind, you actually would see you get a higher accreditation for ELCC than for our planning criteria. But because we're catching it now, there won't be as much hit to anybody that's been counting on capacity from wind. So we're giving them 3 years, and we'll talk about this in a minute. We're giving them 3 years to kind of plan ahead,
sure.
To prepare. So those are the analysis that actually calculate the capacity value of the entire portfolio of assets that we're studying. So when we looked at that average a while ago, was 15%. Is everybody going to get 15% accreditation, or do we need to come up with a different way of allocating how in this case the 6,000 megawatts of solar capacity is going to go? So that's what our allocation methodology is, here referred to as the accreditation white paper. So,
I have a question for you, and maybe it will show up later in the slides. I know the calculations are complex for each resource type. And do you have, and I'm assuming you do, when you overlay wind projections with solar projections, and then you break it out by time of day, whether it's 3 in the afternoon, for example, or 3 in the evening when the sun isn't shining.
Right.
So it's very finite in terms of figuring out the accreditation percentages. Is there something to that effect that a person could look at that wouldn't make my brain explode?
So you want to see, we have load shapes. You know, you can see what the load is at any given hour. You can see what the wind is at any given hour.
Mm-hmm.
See what the solar is at any given hour. And then we'll actually, you know, see, well, this is how many outages of generation we think we'll have at that hour. That's the kind of, you're talking lots of reams of data. Is that the kind of?
Well, isn't that what everything is in effect based on? The extremes, the very high extreme, the very low extreme. Otherwise, you're going to hit a point where at any given time there isn't enough power. Do you account for that just in the reserve margins? And I shouldn't say just, but is that, obviously that's a driving force, reason to have adequate reserve margins
right.
in place.
That's what we're trying to accomplish here by looking at, is going back as far as we can with historical data. And, seeing at any given time where the load's going to be. Because, there may not be any wind, but it may not be a problem because we've got the load is down and we've got plenty of conventional generation on. So it's the probability of all those of that perfect storm happening all at once. That's what we're looking for. Now, as we keep retiring more and more conventional units, we have to redo all this, and, it becomes – really, you start starting over as you if you cut your conventional fleet in half. If you think, we're only going to have 25,000 megawatts of conventional of coal and gas, and we're going to try to serve the rest with wind. That kind of a game changer there. But that's why we're going to study it every year as retirements happen, as more wind comes on, we will project it every year of what needs to happen. Okay, so the policy, really this next part is just kind of the policy we talked about how to allocate this, how to allocate the capacity. So first off, on the study priority, we'll go on to the next couple slides. So what we call the resource study priority. So as we talked about, because the accreditation is decreasing, the more winds you put on, it would, if you're only going to have a small amount of wind, and your accreditation will be higher. So right now, and then our resource adequacy policy would currently require that to be counted for as an accredited resource to serve load that you have firm transmission service, and that's either, being a designated resource on a customer's transmission service agreement or having a firm point-to-point service. So the policy we wanted to get to would actually prioritize generators with firm service. We still want to consider wind and solar that doesn't have firm service, but we also want to have utilities or that are building wind farms, that are building solar facilities, that have some sort of firmness, or at least to know that if I build this facility, that the accreditation is not just going to hit the floor. So we think where we landed with the tiered process will get us there. Next slide. So I'll talk more about the tiers here in a minute. So The SOG landed on what we call three tiers, and so we want to protect some amount of capacity. Tier one actually establishes a floor to the amount of capacity value that each load responsible entity, which is a resource adequacy term, can serve from variable resources. And we think this will encourage firm service, and it'll allow our members more certainty when they're planning their facilities. So if can we go back to the solar graph back up just a hair? Okay, so you'll notice there we talked about SPP's got around 50,000 megawatts of load. We saw here is at 10,000, we see this noticeable change from the accreditation of solar. And so the 10,000 out of 50,000, that's roughly 20%. So what the SOG decided on is at tier one is going to be, we will count to 20% of an LRE's firm service for its solar. Yeah, that's on the, so yeah, solar's 20%. So that means each LRE will know that they can serve at least 20% of their load and get some value, you know, some high degree of accreditation from their solar resource. And it's going to
Charles,
add.
Charles,
yes, ma'am.
A quick question. I'm stumbling over some of your acronyms. What's SOG?
Oh, that's the Supply Adequacy Working Group.
Okay, and that's the LRE?
LRE is a load responsible entity. That is our tariff term for it's a utility that has load to serve.
They're LSEs, I think, in my sense.
LSE, yeah, I think was a NERC term that may not be in use anymore. But, yeah, LSE is used as well.
So your SOG, again, is your?
That's our working group that handles resource adequacy policies.
Okay. And the LREs are utilities?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Sorry, I got you off track, but I could not figure those out. And I was stuck.
That's fine. So by setting this this tier at 10,000, even utilities that haven't put any solar in yet, they can have some certainty that they'll get, you know, on average around 53% capacity from a solar farm. Because what the concern was is there could be some slow adopters, and that if somebody said, "Oh, I'm going to serve 100% of my load with solar," and it pushes that curve way out, then some of the late adopters that are trying to actually serve their load with solar may be stuck with either the 15% average, or they may be stuck with the 0% incremental, depending upon which direction we went.
But so does that mean the early adopters only get a lesser amount too, no matter how much
the 20% up to everybody, any utility gets to serve up to 20% of their peak load, their summer peak load, with nameplate solar. So if you're 10,000 megawatt peak load, your first 2,000 megawatts of solar will be studied in tier one and will on average get around 50% accreditation, depending upon this layout of facilities, which will change. If everybody gets their solar in New Mexico, it's going to be up around 80%. I understand this. We went round and round on this for a while. Okay, Lee, if we back up to slide. Where am I? Is that where it? Okay, so that's what the top 20% is on the solar. Now, wind did not have the precipitous drop-off that solar did. So there was, I guess, some discussion that, well, wind doesn't need this. Some said, no, wind does need this because they thought it worked so well for solar. So we wound up using 35% on wind. And really what that comes out to is that's about where we are now, is we have roughly 13,000 megawatts of firm wind that's designated to utilities across the footprint. The other 7,000 is not firm. So the 13,000 over the 50, it's roughly 35%. So this sets the floor at tier one regardless of the penetration. So no matter how much wind or solar we put on there, those utilities can count on at least 20% of their load having this level of accreditation. So those that want to go, that get firm service on more than 20% are more than welcome to. So the example of the 10,000 megawatt utility, if they've got 4,000 megawatts of solar that is firm, the 2,000 will be in tier one. We'll put the other 2,000 in tier two. So it'll actually still have a higher priority than somebody that doesn't have firm service. And then any resources that are not, that don't have firm service, that are not in tier one and tier two, they'll be studied in tier three. And so those would more than likely be those on the tail end. Okay. All right. So that's the priority. Then, for the allocation load hours, is basically it's kind of like going back to our existing criteria, except we're going to use the load hours only to allocate what the ELCC is. For tier one and tier two, it's going to be the top 3% of their load. And for those that don't have firm service, it's going to be the top 3% of the SPP balancing authority load. So let me see if I can explain this, how it would change. So if we had a wind farm that their top 3% of their hours were showing that they'd get, say they had 1,000 megawatts of wind, their top 3% hours showing they'd get 200 megawatts of capacity. So it would be 200 over 1,000. So there's again 20%. So the way this would work with ELCC is we take the 200 that they have, then we're going to create a ratio of everybody's in tier one of what their top 3% hours are. So when you get that ratio, you then would multiply that times the total ELCC value. So if the total accreditation was, we'd have to go back and look at the graph, but the total accreditation, say it was 20,000 megawatts for our criteria, but it's now going to be 10,000 megawatts for ELCC, they're basically going to get, if that's what it is, they'll get exactly half of what they were getting for that same wind facility, because the ELCC value is the system-wide value, and we're trying to just carry forward the ratios of how those particular facilities are contributing to that system-wide capacity value. So that's where this kind of gets into some calculations as well. Load hours. Did I skip the shape? Yeah, skip the load shape. I'm sorry. So the load shape is kind of, we already talked about it. It's based on the LRE load shape. So the utilities, their actual load shape for tier one and tier two. And then if something does not have firm service, we're going off the entire SPP balancing authority load shape. And so those 3% load hours is just coming off of those load shapes. Okay, implementation. All right, so we did the initial study last year in 2019. We agreed to do an annual study here on out. So just for information, so that people will know what to expect from their existing fleets. It'll be informational only for 20, 21, and 22. Starting in 2023. It's effective for ELCC. For those facilities that actually come into service between studies, they're going to get a flat accreditation similar to what we have now of either 10% of wind or 10% accreditation for wind or 50% accreditation for solar, unless we see that tier three is, unless we see that ELCC is actually much lower than that, and then they'll get whatever the average is for that. So it's going to be to everybody's benefit for those utilities to get their data to us, you know, as soon as they can. Okay, next slide. This is kind of where we're at with just with the policy and the timeline. So let's go through all our acronyms here. So the Supply Adequacy Working Group, that's the SOG. We basically approved the principle in March 2019 that we did want to go to ELCC. In September, we actually approved the policy, and we're currently working on the governing documents. We're seeing what criteria we need to change, what business practices we need to change, maybe tariff changes. Next slide. So our cost allocation working group, the COG, which reports to the RSC, the Regional State Committee. We introduced the topic to the COG in August 2019. And the COG approved in November. And next slide. And then our higher level committees, the MOPC, the board, and the RSC, they all approved the policy in either in October or January of this year. So that where we're at now is we're starting what we call at SPP a revision request. We're writing up business practices. We're changing criteria and looking at any tariff changes to hopefully get this in progress and ready for 2023.
As this process moves along, I'm just trying to think of how to frame this up. You know, future generation just isn't about having a conversation with companies, but also factoring in consumers. And one, it's really just a thought that I keep having when I'm looking at accreditation, projections for wind, projections for solar, how you weight different things, including retirements of existing facilities, distributed energy resources, and storage potential. And within the numbers and the projections, the graphs, is any weight put on those, or is it more of a general conversation? Is it more reactionary, like a potential plant closing, and then now we have to redo the calculations? I mean, it's very, it seems like there's more than one moving target.
Right.
And just generally speaking, how do you account for that?
So in the resource adequacy, because it is the accreditation, we're, the utilities are telling us this, we plan to retire this, you know, on this date. We plan to retire this on this date. So that's really the only input into resource adequacy. The ITP process is actually taking a wider swing at that. They're looking at age of units, they're looking at heat rates, and they're kind of making some projections that we think this is going to retire, we think this is going to retire. So the ITP is taking that into account. Oh, I'm sorry. The Integrated Transmission Plan, that's our main transmission planning process at SPP. So they are taking a wider look at the retirement because this is more performance-based for the utilities have to focus on each year. We're just looking at confirmed retirements.
Yeah, and I think there's a reasonable degree of predictability surrounding that, but then you get into storage and DERs. Mm-hmm.
Storage is, yeah, there's so much to storage. Even in the resource adequacy, we're starting, we've done an ELCC study on that, looking at to see how much capacity, because they're only, you know, they're either 4-hour devices or some are even 2-hour devices, and trying to factor in, well, they may discharge at 10 o'clock in the morning. Are they going to be there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? So there's just a lot of moving just with the batteries. Obviously, they're, you know, great potential there, because if you've got too much wind, you can store it, and then when the wind's down, discharge. So there's a whole lot of potential there. Just trying to capture that in the ELCC process. We're still working on it.
So I have a question for Randy and Victor on this. You've obviously reviewed this stuff through the RSC. How are you feeling about it? What benefits do you think this new approach has, or what concerns did you express in the process? Or I'm just interested in kind of your takeaway on this change and evolution.
I think that moving to the ELCC was the responsible thing to do for long-term reliability. I wish it somehow could proceed faster.
I would
agree. I think it is absolutely the right direction. Is this the end? Should we kind of stop looking at this and stop worrying about it? Absolutely not. Kind of like some of the things Brian had brought up. There's lots of moving pieces to what keeps our system reliable, and this is one of them. So I think this helps for the time being. Mm-hmm. And we need to continue to look at the other areas of concern with retirements and outages and things like that.
The one concern that I have, and it's probably growing, is there's this sort of maybe a disconnect between the grid planners, you know, and the operators and the utilities and the co-ops and the regulators about who ultimately is responsible for reliability. I mean, I've had folks in my so say, like, ultimately it's the utilities and the regulators who need to keep an eye on the mix and make sure that you have enough to serve your load. Yet the RTO is providing the marketplace for those resources to operate in, and if they can't meet their costs and if they're operating at a loss, they're not going to be around. So it's a shared responsibility. And I've just as recently as today had a utility say that, you know, when the RTOs are doing these penetration studies, which kind of is getting to some of your work here on this ELCC, when you're doing the penetration studies on the renewables and you're seeing concerns at the 40-50% range of penetration, you're not speaking loud enough about what those concerns are and what the costs are that we're looking at needing in terms of overbuilding the system in order to operate entirely 100% on renewables or renewables plus battery, what those costs are. So I'm just curious to get your feedback on, are you speaking loud enough about the concerns? And if you aren't, whose job is that?
Okay. Well, I generally don't. Yeah, I'm not speaking from a policy perspective. I mean, we do try. We run the studies and we try to educate everybody. The results, I don't really speak for themselves. They're enlightening to me. I think, you know, I think there could be concerns if. There will be concerns depending on how much retirements of coal, retirements mm-hmm. of gas that we have. But I don't have all the answers.
Well, that says a lot. I mean, that says a lot. You don't view yourself as a policy person, and I don't think most people in these RTOs do. And that's viewed as a policy issue. But you guys are the ones that have the authority to speak on these issues, on how these changes impact the operation of the grid. And there are, you know, there's significant technical issues that need to be understood, even as far as in Wall Street, because they're sending the signals to the utilities that we aren't going to support you if you have coal anymore. And we're, you know, and those are, so there's so many different players involved in this. And making the decisions that, I mean, I've gone through phases of concern, and I'm back on I've got a lot of concerns because there's been some coal facilities in our state that are mine mouth operations that are as efficient as you're going to get in coal, and they're looking at a very real future of possibly not operating. And boy, those are some pretty valuable resources to walk away from. So I don't know. I would say I hope that you guys get some policy people on board to make those arguments and make sure that the folks that need to know know.
Okay. Thank you.
If there's no more questions on the ELCC, we'll move over to the Seams Liaison Committee, which Commissioner Fedorchak, appreciate you serving on that for you. High level, the Seams Liaison Committee is the Seams is a committee between the RSC and the OMS of MISO. We're looking at the seams between the two. There are other seams involved that I don't know. I look that are impactful, but we're really looking strictly at the MISO and SBP seams at the moment. There's a representative from each state along the seams that's serving on the committee, either on the RSC side or the OMS side, for this committee. The committee was formed in October of 2018, and it was to facilitate potential solutions to benefit customers on each side of the seams was the focus of that, and to have regulators involved to help look at things and study with us as long as with MISO and SPP. Originally, there was a joint paper written between with MISO and SPP discussing the seams and seams issues and kind of the process to help educate back in November timeframe. After that paper was completed, we asked for responses from the stakeholders to give their input on what was covered, what issues we found, and what wasn't covered between the two. After that paper was done, in March, the Seams Liaison Committee, the SLC, as they're calling it now, I have to think every time about that. I know they say it's slick. Internally, I get confused. But they engaged the MMUs from both MISO and SPP to review three basic criteria of what's going on in the seams. One was the market-to-market coordination between the two RTOs, rate pancaking to determine the impacts of rate pancaking between the seams and the RTOs, and then even looking at a joint dispatch model if you dispatch along the seams in one area. The market-to-market coordination, the rate pancaking, they did not find very much savings along the seams on that. But when they did the joint dispatch model, they found about $17 million in savings annually on along the seams for that joint dispatch. One of the things I would caveat the study was looking at just doing a joint dispatch. It didn't take into account the business practices of each RTO and how those were different, but it was just looking at doing a joint dispatch across the seams for that savings. Then from the March, the Seams Liaison Committee and asked for stakeholder feedback in February of 2020. We reviewed that feedback at NARUC here just a couple of weeks ago and went ahead and had the MMUs go ahead and do another phase of the study to look at benefits of coordinated transaction scheduling with SPP and MMU and to evaluate the efficiency of the current interface prices and recommend improvements that will better serve the participants with the Seams Liaison Committee. The Seams Liaison Committee was meeting quarterly at NARUC, but now they moved to a monthly meeting to kind of help continue dialogue in between the meetings and push forward with the recommendations and the items from the MMU. But that's the current status, is doing another report from our MMUs and evaluating the benefits of coordinated transaction scheduling and the interface pricing. Commissioner, I don't know if you have anything to add or questions, discussions. It's a very brief overview, as I said.
Yeah.
much quicker than
it's a little bit less technical.
Well, I think what's interesting and puzzling about the seams is some of the information coming from the studies in terms of the cost savings is a lot less than I think what a lot of people believe it to actually be and or anticipate to be. And so I guess I would summarize it to say the ultimate goal is to find ways to have so the seams are just the locations where SPP, in this case, and MISO overlap, and how power transfers across those seams. There's a lot of complicated tariffs and agreements made that charge customers on both sides, and it's a very, very complicated. And in some places, there's only a few little paths for that power to cross. So, I mean, identifying, are there more paths that should be built to improve the amount of wind and different types of resources that can get across to better serve more efficiently and at a lower cost to customers on both sides? Are there ways of operating that can improve that? Are there ways of you know, changing the tariffs? Are they fair? You know, all these sorts of things. And just even the caps that exist between the exchanges of power between the two sides, you know, all of these things create barriers, and barriers have costs. And who pays for those costs? Customers. Nobody else. Ultimately, those are borne by the people in Bismarck and the people in throughout SPP who pay it through their utility bills. And so that's where it's a lot of really complicated, tiresome work that can easily be, quite honestly, ignored because it's complicated and tiresome, and the people baked into the various RTOs understand it, and there's a few of them, and just everyone else throws their hands up and says, well, I guess that's just the way it has to be. And this seams group is saying we're not comfortable with that. And so it's taking a while. It's a time-consuming process, but I don't see any of the regulators on either side feeling like we've gotten to where we want to be yet, and so we're going to keep pushing. And FERC is saying, yeah, keep pushing. So I think that there's more to come, and I think that ultimately it will be a fruitful endeavor, but it's taken a while to get there.
I agree with your comments on that fruitful endeavor. I think it will be, we will get there, and it will be very beneficial across the seams as we move forward.
I think there have been improvements already, just in terms of the amount of communication and the level of commitment between the two RTOs to work together and understanding that this is the time has come, this has to happen.
And now I want to bring that together with your previous question about, like, who really has responsibility here if things mm-hmm. go badly. So there was a time when commissioners in these seats wouldn't have asked that. Decades ago, when companies, when they had, planned outages or something, coordinated with themselves, and if they didn't do a good, and of course we had pretty much almost complete baseload power as opposed to intermittent. But, everybody knew at the time that the responsibility was with the companies, and to the extent they were jurisdictional, with the regulators. Now with the RTOs, we're asking that question. You asked it, I've asked it, you know, and I think the blame is going to go to regulators to a lesser extent. If there were reliability problems, you might get a few calls at the company level. We could have enormous reliability problems and nobody's going to call SPP or MISO from North
right.
Dakota. But a lot of the, and so the blame, I think, comes to us. The responsibility, I think you're right. It's more with them that are creating the parameters of these markets. So now, while I fully endorse the seam study and a lot of the accomplishments that have been made, because I like saving money too, but I think we need to be cautious that it doesn't go too far. Not every efficiency comes without a cost and reliability. And to the extent we keep focusing too much on efficiencies and erase all the differences that are there because someone thought it was important to have that difference, I think we go from what has become this big system of these large RTOs to kind of a national system with even less responsibility. And so I hope that it doesn't come to that, mm-hmm. that we erase all differences just for, at some point, what would become minimal efficiency gains and lose mm-hmm. all of the responsibility.
I agree with you, Randy. My thought is that it should improve reliability, whatever comes out of it, you know, enhance that.
So.
Moving on. All right. So, I'm not sure. I didn't make the last trip to North Dakota. I think it was Sam and Lee, maybe Paul. I don't remember. And so I'm not sure how much they briefed y'all on the things that SPP has going on out in the West. So I thought I'd take a few minutes just to walk through that with you all. So if we go to the next slide. So I don't think it's news to anybody that SPP is put forth an effort over the last couple of years for westward expansion and looking at options out in the West to bring market services or imbalance services, reliability coordination, whatever we can do to help entities out in the West. And so so we got currently three things that are going: an unscheduled flow mitigation, which we started back in 2018. It's in a form of a contract with some utilities out there. Western Reliability Coordination Services. So we are the reliability coordinator for a number of entities out in the West, and we worked on that for around 18 months, and it went live back at the beginning of December. Going live was pretty much a non-event, to be honest. The day it happened, I forgot that was the day it was happening, and we didn't hear anything. So that's good, right? Reliability, you don't hear anything, is good. And then you know, next, we have a number of entities that we've been working with to form a Western Energy Imbalance Service market, so an EIS market, EIS services market out in the West. And so our target date for that is February 2021. We're in the process now of putting together all the software package and getting that operational. If we go to the next thing, so this Western Energy Imbalance Service we call WISE. I didn't make that up. So another acronym for us. So again, it's a contract-based service that we have with these parties in the West. It is separate and distinct from any of our RTO services that we provide today, and it'll actually be operated under its own filed tariff with FERC. That tariff is currently being, or has been, the draft tariff has been developed by what's called the Western Markets Executive Committee, the WMEC. They're actually meeting later this week out in Denver, and that they have the authority of putting together those protocols and putting together that tariff. That tariff has been approved by the SPP Board of Directors. I mean, the WMEC is acknowledged by the SPP Board as a stakeholder group, and the board has acknowledged that initial tariff, and we expect to actually file that tariff this Friday with FERC. Okay, so it does have to go to FERC for approval. You know, really the value of this WISE market is that it leverages some of the best practices that we've used in markets since 2007. In 2007, SPP, prior to our day-ahead market, our integrated marketplace, we launched an EIS market, an energy imbalance services market that we ran for 7 years and had significant benefits and values for our stakeholders and customers. And so, you know, along with those things that we learned from 2007 to 2014 and those foundational concepts that are already out there in the West, really are going to provide the value for our Western members or our Western market participants. So we talked about the people participating in this. Again, it's a contract basis. We had five original participants that agreed back in September of 2019 to go forward with this energy imbalance services market concept. And since then, we've added three additional people have signed on to this Western Joint Dispatch Agreement, which is the contract that manages this imbalance services market. So the WAPA, Colorado, Missouri, or sometimes called the WACM BA, the Municipal Energy of Nebraska, and the Wyoming Municipal Power Authority have since signed on. At this point in time, I think this will be the list of initial participants in that market, and then we'll continuing to seek additional participants out in the West. And so approximately about 6 months after go live, so somewhere in the late summer of 2021, we expect to
start adding additional participants as they sign on.
When did you say, late in 21?
February 2021 is our current expected implementation date. So 6 months after that, which is August, September, somewhere right along in there. So I assume y'all are familiar with the imbalance services market, allows entities that have excess generation to put those into a market, people to purchase that at a lower cost than they could have generated for themselves. So mm-hmm. technically a win-win. Mm-hmm. So everything in this Weiss market, again, is subject to a financial settlement. It's a 5-minute settlement and based on an economic dispatch of that using the current transmission structure that's out in the West today. So again, not calling at this point for any additional transmission being built or any additional costs, just using what's already out there. So we like to talk about, talked a little bit about kind of what it is, contract. Again, it's not, consolidating any of those balancing authorities out there. It's not providing any of the what you might think of as the normal RTO sort of functionality. There's no day-ahead market component of this market yet. There's no congestion hedging rights. Ancillary services still responsibility of the existing BAs out there. We're not doing any transmission planning. This thing says reliability coordination. A portion of this market footprint is within the current reliability coordination footprint we have out in the West today. So it certainly supplements. Those two things work very well together, but not dependent on each other. And then there is no consolidation of any kind of tariffs or anything that they already have out there in the West. So again, our role is like our role in other things we do. We're mainly administrators and facilitators. So again, we're administering the role of the market process. We're facilitating working with those members out there, their regulators. And the regulators do have a role, which we'll talk about in out there. We're helping to support the reliability that we already have that function under our reliability coordination. And we're also providing oversight through our market monitoring unit. So I think I think Greg came last time and talked to you a little bit about the role of the market monitor within SPP and the role that they take. And again, that same functionality will be used out there in the West, in this Western market, overseeing those markets to make sure that they remain viable and no gaming opportunities and remain above board.
So who does? Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
Clarify the difference between the two slides. You will not provide reliability coordination, but you support reliability.
Yeah, so a market service itself is not reliability coordination. Okay, it is an imbalanced service market. Okay, reliability coordination is a separate function that we have another contract in the West that we're providing for these members that are in this Weiss market and others. And then a smaller set of those participants have decided to come into this Weiss market. So again, we are providing reliability coordination in the West. It's not dependent on being part of this Western market, okay, or vice versa.
And then who does the balancing for this market?
So the balancing authorities?
Yeah.
The BAs that are out there now. So the balancing authorities that
can
are.
Can you give me some examples of who that is?
Yeah. So when you go back to the participants themselves, mm-hmm. these are general balancing authorities. Okay. So they are balancing the incoming and outgoming energy within their areas.
And then they're saying we have excess, we want to sell it.
Yeah. So one thing we did when we started the integrated marketplace with SPP is we took the 18 individual balancing authorities that were existing in SPP and we consolidated those all into one. That was part of the value of our day two market or integrated marketplace when we implemented that back in 2014 was to sort of break down those walls and do all of that in a centralized function.
Okay.
So we're not doing that for this market, is I guess what we're saying. As far as governance, so again, this Western Markets Executive Committee has people that have signed on to this Western JDA have a seat at the table on that. Again, it's recognized by the board.
They meet like most other SPP stakeholder meetings. It's open meeting. Anybody can attend, usually by teleconference or in person. You know, their rules are, you know, their goals are to finalize these market rules, put together this tariff, deal with tariff changes, any kind of ongoing market changes as we go forward. They own the budget. Again, they invest in, you know, they invest as part of their investment into SPP is they pay the budget for what it costs to run this market. And so they help us manage that budget and where those dollars go and how those dollars get spent. And then the other part of that is the state commission liaison, okay, role. And so the state commissions have a active seat at the table where they're allowed, where they have the ability to have an advisory role on any of the changes that take place going forward in this market. So I think it's similar to I wouldn't say similar to the RSC, but they do have a seat at the table. They don't have any, you know, the RSC has real authority, 205 filing authority on certain things with SPP. These guys will just have more of an advisory role, which is the role that they were interested in having. And so going forward, what is kind of the near-term roadmap look like? You know, back in September of 2019, you know, we started our implementation efforts. October, we started first putting together this Western Market Executive Committee process and started holding meetings with them. I think they meet monthly by teleconference, maybe a little bit more than monthly when they've been dealing with some tariffs and market protocols. They've January 2020, the board approved their governing documents. August of this year, we expect to start some market trials, and then February 2021 go live. So everything is green light going forward at the moment. So, and then ultimately, you know, SPP will continue to seek out opportunities in the West. We continue to be pretty active out in the West in meeting with different you know, potential market participants, regulators, non-government people, you know, anybody who wants to learn more about this market, or, you know, we've been setting up time to meet with them. And so, you know, and also looking at how do we, you know, if you look at the next slide, so this real-time market operations or optimization, you know, these four DC ties that are sort of the North Four, the Sydney, the Rapid City, the Miles City, and the Stegall, how do you continue to optimize those for eventual looking at flows between the two and optimize flows between the eastern side of SPP and the western side of SPP to make sure that, you know, ratepayers are being able to capture the lowest cost resources in each of the respective markets. And so after that, I think I just have a couple of maps. So that's our current, the Weiss footprint in blue, the SPP current footprint in red. And go to the next one, that's actually better. So that has the RC footprint. So as I was talking before, the Weiss footprint makes up a portion of the RC footprint we have in the West. And so that is a quick overview of what we have going on in the West, and again, be more to come on that because we're continuing to move pretty fast out there. So, well, if there's y'all have any additional questions or anything else you would like to.
The RC footprint, is that exactly what the Mountain West expansion was, or is it?
It's pretty close. Yeah, it's pretty close. There's a few people that signed on. It is the Mountain West footprint plus a few. How about that?
So that's an easier way to say it. There's eight participants in the Weiss footprint, right?
Correct.
How many more make up the RC
footprint? I'm going off memory. Numbers are not always my good thing. I think there's 15 or 16 participants in the RC footprint. Yeah. Okay. I can get you a list of that.
Counting the eight.
Yes. Total. So 8 additional. Yep.
Victor, Adam, do you have any thoughts, questions?
Nope. I have nothing to add.
I know you have a lot of thoughts, questions.
I'm good.
Randy, anything else?
Nothing else except for to say, and we didn't really highlight it at the beginning, Victor is a star of the COG, the something working group. Can't remember what the name is. Cost allocation working group, yeah. Victor is a key element of that group. Appreciate his time.
Well, thank you for the time you put into the presentation, sharing the information with us. And I said this early on, but it's a complex equation with so many different stakeholders involved from the state level, the federal level, the corporate level, the consumer level, and not to mention just the other multitude of factors that have to go into all of this. So it's not an easy task, and I think the leadership policy question is, we just have to be honest in that that's a very difficult thing to really have clarity on with so many different, how does the saying go, a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So, and everyone has their own interest, and what motivates one doesn't necessarily motivate another. And then you have to intertwine that with advancing technology and increasing penetration of renewables on the grid, which is a significant question that needs to be answered as we move forward. How to handle, I think it's the first 5% I think it's safe to say, or 10% penetration was a lot easier than the next 10%, which was a lot, a little easier than the next 10%. It becomes increasingly more difficult to balance it out. But at the end of the day, what does it mean to consumers? Well, I will say this, in terms of the corporate players, they have utility bills as well. So increased cost to them, if that should occur, will also get their attention along the way. So, but thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, guys.
And I'll see you in Little Rock.
Little Rock. Little Rock.